I'm really pleased to have Niels Holter come down from Copenhagen to talk with us today. He's pointed out to me that he needs no introduction because it's all here on the screen. You'll notice that I got his affiliation wrong on the announcement that I sent out and on the term card. This was all explained to me a little while ago. The one center that they had folded, and then they got a new center, so he's now at the director of the Center for Advanced Migration Studies rather than director of the other center that I said he was director of, which, you know, he's not a director of that non-existent object. And he's, as you also saw in the announcement I sent around, he's written very extensively, lots of papers on lots of issues. He has a very significant book called Persons, Interests, and Justice, OUP, I think 2011. There's a lot of material in the early chapters on what Parfit in Reasons and Persons called What Matters. It's not what matters in volumes 1 and 2, it's what matters in Reasons and Persons that Niels was writing about, and lots of very interesting stuff in later chapters on issues and population ethics and so on. In fact, we were just at Parfit's house a minute ago, and Derek was saying how much he admired this book. It's something he's told me before on a number of occasions when we've talked about these issues. So that's our speaker, and Niels, over to you.
Okay, thanks, Jeff, for the kind words, and thank you for inviting me here. It's always great to be back in Oxford. So what I'm going to talk about is international migration, and I want to talk about the implications of a particular distributive principle in political philosophy, luck egalitarianism, popular principle, and what the implications are for what we should think about international migration. So some of the questions I want to think about are, so in most Western liberal democracies, we have asymmetrical rights for citizens and immigrants. And there's a question of whether that's justified or not. Many egalitarians argue that, you know, such inequalities aren't justified. Immigrants should have the same rights as citizens have. So that's one kind of question I want to consider. The other question I want to consider is, should we have open borders? Does luck egalitarianism apply that we should have open borders? So let me first just say a little bit about what I take luck egalitarianism to be. So luck egalitarianism is the view that it is unfair if some individuals have lower levels of advantages than others through no responsibility of their own. So this is an egalitarianism that's sensitive to responsibility. Sometimes when people are worse off than others, that may be their own responsibility. In that case, they're not entitled to egalitarian compensation, according to luck egalitarianism. But if they're worse off than others through no responsibility of their own, then they are entitled to such compensation, everything else being equal. I want to distinguish between two versions of luck egalitarianism that differ in their account of the scope of this principle. So according to global luck egalitarianism, this is so irrespective of these people's nationality, citizenship, race, and the like. So inequalities between people that aren't due to their own responsibility are unfair, no matter whether these people have the same, are members of the same nation, of the same ethnic group, or whatever, right? So in this is the sense in which this principle has global scope. According to domestic luck egalitarianism, it's only inequalities between members of the same state that are unfair, insofar as these inequalities are not in the relevant way linked to these people's responsible agency. So domestic luck egalitarianism has domestic scope only, right? I shall mostly be concerned about global luck egalitarianism. That's simply because I think it's the more plausible of these two views. I'm not going to argue it, really. I'm just going to assume that that's the principle that we want to talk about. except for one question, which I shall address in terms of domestic life egalitarianism. That's because that question really only arises within a framework of domestic life egalitarianism. So the question is, what are the implications for international migration of this principle? And the particular kind of migration I shall be talking about is south-north migration, right? So the kind of case I have in mind is the migration of relatively poor, low-skilled people migrating to Western liberal democracies where people are, on average, much better off. That's the kind of case I'm thinking about. Now, of course, that's not always the case. You know, people may migrate from the global south to the global north and not be poor or low-skilled, but this is the kind of case I have in mind here. So let me be a bit more precise about the questions I want to pose. The first question relates to the responsibility sensitivity of luck egalitarianism. And the question is, are voluntary migrants responsible for their migration in such a way that receiving societies are justified in extending to them a less comprehensive set of rights than, for example, citizens have or non-voluntary migrants have? Does the fact that these people have chosen to migrate somehow justify that they aren't entitled to as extensive a set of rights as citizens have? Because some people might argue, well, they've chosen to migrate. That's a choice they've made, and luck egalitarianism holds people responsible for their choices. And if they find themselves worse off in some ways in the country they've migrated to, well, that's their own responsibility. I should address this question in terms of domestic luck egalitarianism, because it really only makes sense as a question within domestic luck egalitarianism, because the kind of case we're thinking about is that citizens are entitled to the extensive set of rights. That's the kind of thought that people have when they make this argument. Whereas on global luck egalitarianism, you know, it's not that clear that people are entitled to as extensive a set of rights, social rights, social benefits, and so on, as we have. So the kind of inequality we're talking about there is between migrants and citizens in their destination country. Okay. The second question concerns global luck egalitarianism, which I take to be the more plausible view here. And it also pertains to whether asymmetrical rights between citizens and immigrants can be justified. Since global luck egalitarianism focuses on global rather than domestic inequality, does it justify the claim that rights asymmetries between immigrants and other members of destination societies are unjust? So if we were domestic egalitarians and we had these inequalities, and assuming that they aren't due to people's own responsibility, we would have unfair inequalities. But it's not clear that we would also have unfair inequalities on global luck egalitarianism, because an increase in domestic inequality need not also be an increase in global inequality. In fact, an increase in domestic inequality can be an increase in global equality. I should get back to how that can be the case. And the final question is, to what extent does global luck egalitarianism justify open borders? The thought being that by having open borders, we can allow relatively poor, unskilled migrants to obtain a higher standard of living than they would otherwise have access to. And that seems to be an improvement in terms of global equality. I should emphasize that my focus here is on luck egalitarianism. We might think that there are all sorts of other principles that are relevant for assessing these questions. So freedom of movement, for instance, many people would argue is a relevant concern as regards open borders, or that questions of democratic legitimacy or national self-determination or freedom of association might be relevant principles for assessing open borders, but I should focus only on the implications of Lucky Bell Jameson. Okay, so let me say something more about what Lucky Bell Jameson is. I want to remain relatively neutral between different accounts of Lucky Bell Jainism, so what I shall say will be somewhat general. Insofar as an individual is worse off than others through no responsibility of her own, this may reflect either of two things. It may reflect that the options that were available to her were less valuable than the options that were available to others. Right? So a person may be worse off than others through no responsibility of her own because the options that were available to her were worse than other people's options. So simple case, suppose A and B have equally many options, but all of A's options are better than all of B's options, right? Then clearly A will end up better off than B, and B will be worse off through no responsibility of her own. Because no matter what she'd done, she would have ended up worse off than A. So in that way, inequality is sensitive to the value of options. More generally, the value of option sets must be construed as some kind of aggregate. So it must be the case that it must be possible that some of my options are better than some of your options, some of my options are worse than some of your options, but overall, my option set is worse than your set. So it must be possible to aggregate somehow these different options. So the other way in which an individual can be worse off than others through no responsibility of her own is because of a difference in the ability to choose prudently between options. Right? So I may be less able to pick out the best options, make the best choices for myself, where this is not through my own responsibility. How so? Well, I may lack knowledge, for instance, the knowledge that would make it possible for me to pick the best options I have. I may lack, I may have weaker cognitive powers than other people. I may suffer from weakness of the will. And there may be various reasons why I'm not very good at picking out my best options, making the best choices I can. And insofar as these, I'm less able to make these choices, aren't, that is my own responsibility, then, you know, insofar as I make poorer choices than other people and end up worse off for that reason, I'll be worse off through no responsibility of my own. Or we may have cases in which one and two here interact in various ways. I don't want to go into that, both because it gets complicated and because I don't really need that degree of detail in the argument I shall make. Now, according to Lucky Egalitarianism, individuals should be held responsible for choices made from a platform of equal options, right? So if people have equal options and then make choices, then they should be held responsible for these choices. And so if they end up worse off than other people, Lucky Egalitarians are going to say, well, that's their own responsibility. They're not entitled to compensation, even though they're worse off than other people. And here, equal options reflect both the value of option sets and the ability to choose prudently within these sets. So this is what various Lucky Egalitarians argue. So a couple of examples. Richard Arneson argues that, so he has a view he calls equality of opportunity for welfare, according to which two people have, or equality obtains between two people if there is a one-to-one match between their options and the value of the values of these options, and they're equally capable of making the best choices. So that's clearly in line with what I've said here. Dworkin, who, by the way, doesn't really consider himself a Lucky Egalitarian, but for present purposes at least, I think we can. It doesn't really matter. He's the kind of person I want to include in this argument. So he thinks that equality obtains insofar as people have equal purchasing power, corrected for lack of health and talents. And so if we correct for lack of health and talents, we may think that if a person is unable to walk, for instance, that will reduce the value of her option set, or it may reduce the value of her option set. So that would be the one here, that her options are less valuable. It may be that she has fewer cognitive skills, and for that reason should be compensated, perhaps in terms of having more resources than other people. That would be the kind of way Dworkin would want to compensate. And so Dworkin also sort of fits this picture or description of Lockyer-Gard's anism. Okay. So if individuals should be held responsible for choices made from a platform of equal options. But if, on the other hand, choices are made from unequal sets, and an individual with a worse set ends up worse off, this cannot be justified with reference to the element of choice, because that person chose from a worse set of options. Okay. I shall be quite neutral regarding the currency of egalitarian justice, so we might think that people should be equal with respect to welfare or resources or capabilities or something else. I'll just rather loosely talk about advantages, and that's supposed to cover the whole spectrum of possible currencies. However, irrespective of which currency we choose for our egalitarian principle, the world as it is grossly unjust, according to Lockyer-Gardianism, right? So, for example, if we look at the Gini coefficient in a relatively unequal country such as the US, in 2000, there was a Gini coefficient of 37, where the Gini coefficient measures inequality, how much we'd have to redistribute in order to get a perfectly equal distribution. So whereas the Gini in the US in year 2000 was 37, for the world as a whole, in 2002, it was 71. According to Oxfam, almost half of the world's wealth is owned by 1% of its population. And the 85 richest people in the world own the same as the bottom half. Right. So the world is a grossly unequal place. And according to egalitarianism, it's a grossly unjust place. Also, a preliminary remark, Lockyer-Gardianians should be concerned about efficiency. They shouldn't just be concerned about equality. If they were concerned only with equality, they wouldn't care whether we had equality at low levels or equality at high levels. That just wouldn't matter. Because if we had perfect equality, then that is all we're concerned about as egalitarians. So egalitarians have to be concerned also about efficiency, how much we have to distribute and redistribute. Because naturally they will prefer equality at high levels to equality at low levels. So if we could make either everyone very well off and equally well off, we should prefer that to making everyone equally well off but very poorly off. A final sort of preliminary remark. Although I shall be focusing on Lockyer-Gardianism, what I say will be equally relevant for other distributive principles such as Lockyer-Gardianism, which I mentioned because I've elsewhere defended prioritarianism over egalitarianism. But for the purposes of this discussion, my argument works just as well with egalitarianism as with prioritarianism. Okay. So let me consider this first question I mentioned. Are migrants, voluntary migrants, somehow responsible for their choice of migrating in such a way that we can justify extending to them a less comprehensive set of rights than that of citizens? Okay, so let's think about immigration and the particular kind of immigration I'm talking about here. So migrating to a new country often involves costs of various kinds, having to learn a new language, having to find a new job, establishing new networks, coping with new societal rules and bureaucratic procedures, including immigration authorities, having diminished political and social rights as non-citizen newcomers, and finding one's way in a culture that in many ways may be quite foreign to one's own. And for reasons such as these, egalitarians have often argued that inequalities between immigrants and citizens, asymmetrical rights for immigrants and citizens, are unfair. So as Michael Walzer argues, not to give immigrants access to citizenship is like a family with live-in servants. It's unfair. But like egalitarianism isn't just sensitive to inequalities, it's also sensitive to responsibility. So while these costs may give rise to fewer or worse options for immigrants than other members of society have, our receiving society is nevertheless justified in extending to voluntary immigrants a reduced set of rights in virtue of the fact that they have chosen to immigrate. And in fact, this is argued by Will Kimlicker in the case of cultural rights. So Will, he argues that if we have, in some country, we have a national majority, they may be entitled to quite an extensive set of cultural rights, including, in some cases, territorial rights. But voluntary immigrants will never be entitled to that because they have chosen to migrate to their destination country. So it might also be impractical for immigrants to have territorial rights because they will usually be quite dispersed over a country. But apart from that, and on a more principled level, they aren't entitled to territorial rights because they've chosen to leave their own culture and migrate to another country. So leaving one's culture is a way of waiving some of one's cultural rights, according to Kimlicker. Now, I want to consider this question more generally than Will does. So Kimlicker here considers only cultural rights. I want to consider political rights, social rights, and cultural rights. Because if we think that we're somehow responsible in relation to our cultural rights insofar as we migrate, why wouldn't we also think that we were responsible as concerns our social and political rights? And again, remember that when discussing this question, I'm focusing on domestic inequality. So it's the inequality in a particular state between citizens and immigrants. Okay. Now, return to what I said about luck egalitarianism. And I should also mention that Will makes this his argument for cultural rights on the basis of what seems at least quite close to a luck egalitarian argument. He says justice is about rectifying unchosen inequalities, which is what a luck egalitarian would say. Now, the choice of migrating is, in most cases, made from a platform of less valuable option sets than most members of the receiving society have, given the kind of immigrants I'm considering here, that is low-skilled, poor immigrants migrating to a country where people on average are much better off than they are. So they're making that choice from a platform of less valuable option sets. And in particular, simplifying a little bit, but the choice of migrating may in many cases be the migrant's best option, in the sense that it's the option that will bring the migrant closest to enjoying equality with citizens in the destination state. Which means that even after having made the best choice available to her, she's worse off than citizens of the receiving society on average are. Right, so while we could say that people, insofar as people have made a suboptimal choice and end up worse off than other people, that may, to some extent at least, be their own responsibility. But what we can't say is that people have made that have made the very best choice they could make and are still worse off than other people are, that they're worse off through their own responsibility. I should perhaps also say that there are a number of reasons why these immigrants have less valuable option sets. So, you know, they have may have a relative lack of resources, relative lack of education, fewer job opportunities, little access to adequate health care, and so on. And many of these disadvantages they will bring with them to the destination country. They will still have less education. And so on. So the resulting inequality is largely due to reasons for which immigrants cannot be said to be responsible. And this means that asymmetries in rights that contribute to this inequality cannot be justified with reference to the immigrant's choice of migrating, because they made that choice from a platform of less valuable options. So, asymmetrical rights cannot be justified in this way, according to, even though luck egalitarianism is sensitive to responsibility, we cannot justify asymmetrical rights in this way, I argue. Now, so far I've considered only inequalities between immigrants and other members of the destination societies. But inequalities in domestic, or increases in domestic inequality need not increase global inequality. So now I want to consider an argument for asymmetrical rights that doesn't use domestic luck egalitarianism as a point of departure, but global luck egalitarianism. So why don't domestic inequality and global inequality go together? Why can we have increases in domestic inequality, such as when immigrants arrive, that aren't also increases in global inequality? Well, okay, it's a simple example. I don't need to write it down. Suppose we have two different distributions. In the first distribution, and we have two only two societies, and in these two societies, there are only two people in each. In the first distribution, the two people in one society have five units each of whatever we think the currency of egalitarian justice is, right? So it may be resources, it may be welfare, whatever we think is important. So the first group has, the first society has a distribution of 5-5, and the second society has a distribution of 1-1. But now we change, we redistribute, such that in the first society, we take two units from one person, so that we now have a distribution of 5-3, and we give these two units to the person to a person in the other society, such that we there now have a distribution of 3-1. Right. So what we've done is to go from a situation of perfect domestic equality, 5-5 and 1-1, to a situation in which we have significant domestic inequality, 5-3 and 3-1, but we've also increased global equality because people, the world as a whole, is now more equal. And that just follows from the so-called Pigou-Dalton principle of transfer. So if we take a certain amount of advantages from one person, a better-off person, and give these advantages to a worse-off person without affecting anyone else, and without reversing their positions, then that's an improvement in equality, according to the Pigou-Dalton principle. And if we look at the world today, this is, in a way, what's going on. Societies are becoming more unequal, but the world as a whole is becoming more equal. So according to domestic egalitarians, the world is becoming worse. According to global egalitarians, it's becoming better. Okay. Now turn to the argument for asymmetrical rights. Compare these two policies. We could either give immigrants access to a full set of political, social, and cultural rights, or we could deny immigrants a full set of rights, give them something less than this. they would still have rights, but not as extensive social rights, for instance, as citizens have. And let's think about this in terms of global egalitarianism. Now, this second option, denying immigrants a full set of rights, might actually render immigrants closer to the global average of advantages, and so better promote global equality. So it would seem that there was a global egalitarian argument for not giving immigrants access to a full set of rights. However, if we deny immigrants a full set of rights, that may decrease efficiency in various ways. And as I said, egalitarians worry not just about equality, they also worry about efficiency. It may decrease efficiency because of the diminishing marginal utility of money and because of effects of equality on, for example, trust, health, and education. So there are all these social science studies that show that insofar as there's more inequality, there's less trust, lower levels of health, lower levels of education, and so on. So there are also all sorts of efficiency losses due to inequality. And also recently, of course, both the IMF and the OECD have argued that inequality, socioeconomic inequality, harms growth. So there are various kinds of efficiency losses because of inequality. But also, presumably, at least in comprehensive welfare states, non-immigrants will be economically, citizens will be economically worse off under the first policy. Which will tend to increase global equality, right? So if citizens are to share some of their wealth with immigrants, they will be worse off. But the fact that they're worse off actually tends to increase global equality. So there will be an increase in global equality because of citizens being worse off if they share their wealth with immigrants or other social advantages. Now, there is some evidence that citizens in Western countries benefit from immigration, even low-skilled, poor migrants. But presumably these advantages that citizens get, they would get in any case in either of these two policies we're now comparing, because these benefits result from immigrants taking up jobs, and they would do that whether they have access to a full set of rights or not. Perhaps they would even have a greater incentive to take up jobs if they don't have a full set of rights. Right. So it seems that we should prefer giving immigrants access to a full set of rights when comparing these two policies as global egalitarians. But now consider a third policy. Namely, denying immigrants a full set of rights and using the resources saved to further open borders, and so giving more immigrants access to the benefits of the welfare state. Now, this may in fact be the best policy of those so far considered, because more low-skilled, poor immigrants get access to various kinds of benefits that increase their standard of living, which will tend to increase global equality. So that would be an argument for asymmetrical rights. But now consider a final policy, namely universally reducing the package of rights in order to be able to take in more immigrants. After all, global egalitarianism doesn't give us any reason to single out immigrants as recipients of a less than full package of rights, right? So the fourth option would be to universally reduce the package of rights in order to be able to take in more immigrants and give them access to benefits which would improve global equality. So by universally reducing the set, one could make room for yet more immigrants. And since there would be less domestic inequality, because we were reducing, giving everyone equal rights, although a reduced set, the negative effects of efficiency I was talking about that accompany inequality would be avoided. Okay. Now, first note that this argument is made in what we can call ideal theory,
right?
It's about what would be best in these particular circumstances. Or at least it holds, it's in, at least in some ways an ideal argument. Because if we take into account people's actual motivations, the actual motivations of electorates, this may be somewhat unrealistic to sort of have a policy of decreasing the welfare state in order to take in more poor immigrants. And suppose for that reason it wasn't possible to have that kind of policy. Well, it would be unfair, it might be the best we could do, but it would still be unfair not to do so in terms of this argument. So, global luck egalitarianism may well favor symmetrical rights, that's what I've argued, just like domestic luck egalitarianism. It doesn't justify rights asymmetries. But there are two differences we should note here between global luck egalitarianism and domestic luck egalitarianism. First, global luck egalitarianism is less principled in its opposition to asymmetrical rights in a given, in a particular state than domestic luck egalitarianism is. It's all a question of what, in fact, tends to promote global equality the most. And, of course, domestic luck egalitarianism wouldn't favor the fourth option here, universally reducing the package of rights in order to bring in more immigrants, because domestic luck egalitarians wouldn't think, not qua egalitarians at least, that we should be concerned about the advantages of people living in other states. Okay. So I've also argued that this second argument for asymmetrical rights that I've considered fails. As global egalitarians, we shouldn't favor asymmetrical rights either. That doesn't mean that, for instance, an immigrant, the day he or she sets her foot on the soil of the destination country, should have access to every possible right in that society. It may make sense to withhold certain rights for a period of time, voting rights, for instance. It may make sense to withhold voting rights, reserve them for people who have a long-term interest in the country, so not just for people staying for 2 months or half a year or 1 year, but so there may be various reasons, pragmatic reasons for not giving people access to a full package of rights the moment they set their foot on in the new country. But in principle, this is an argument for symmetrical rights. Okay, so far I have been saying that taking in more poor, low-skilled immigrants will tend to increase global equality. But is that true? So now I want to consider, so that would imply that opening up borders now would increase global equality. And now I want to consider that question. So global luck egalitarians, or people sympathetic to that view, or who roughly have that kind of view, will often argue that open borders are an implication of such egalitarianism. So as Joseph Cairns, for instance, aptly puts it, citizenship in Western liberal democracies is the modern equivalent of feudal privilege, an inherited state that greatly enhances one's life chances. And that, of course, is everything that that luck egalitarians are against. So putting it slightly differently, since no one chooses where he or she is born, the inequalities in life chances that flow from such circumstances are unfair, and so are the coercive barriers that prevent people from migrating to places where they might improve their standard of living. So where you happen to be born is a question of pure luck, right? It's not something for which you hold responsibility. And so if you're worse off just because of the place you happen to be born, that's an unjust inequality according to global luck egalitarianism. So why will south-north migration tend to increase global equality? Well, there are two reasons for this. First, it improves the standard of living of immigrants. So, for instance, wages in developed countries are typically exceed those in developing countries by 4 to 12 times. And even if we take comparable jobs and requiring the same amount of skills, they're much better paid in developed countries. So because it benefits the immigrants, that's one reason why immigration, or the kind of migration we're talking about, tends to increase global equality. The other reason is remittances, so the money migrants send back to family and friends in their countries of origin. So let me say a little bit about remittances. Namely, that these are, in fact, enormously significant. So recorded remittances to developing nations in 2007 were 4.5 times the size of global development aid. The contribution of personal remittances to GDP in 2011 in a selection of countries, Liberia 23%, Nepal 22%, Samoa 22%, and Tajikistan 47%. So these countries are actually quite dependent on remittances. Now there are these discussions about whether remittances actually also promote development or they just benefit the families that receive them. And there's actually some evidence now that remittances improve quite a lot of important things in developing countries. So they diminish child labor, they increase education, and have various other important implications. Right, so for these reasons, international migration of the kind I'm talking about tends to increase global equality. So as global luck egalitarians, we should think that's a good thing. Now, as I said, as global luck egalitarians, we should also be concerned about efficiency. So let me also say something about that after I've said this. So just more about the effects of migration. According to some estimates, the effects of increasing south-north migration by an annual 3% might produce net benefits that exceed the combined effect of meeting national targets for development aid, cancelling all third world debt, and abolishing all barriers to third world trade. And for reasons such as these, we find the UNDP proposing more open borders as a means for promoting development and global equality of opportunity. Now about the efficiency gains of more open borders. Now, it's generally acknowledged amongst economists that international migration tends to increase global growth. So according to some studies, lifting immigration controls could more than double the world GNP. The World Bank finds that if rich countries increased their workforce by 3% by taking in migrants from developing nations, the net gains would amount to $356 billion, where natives in high-income countries gain $139 billion, people who remain in the countries of origin, $143 billion, and migrants themselves get the largest share of $162 billion. So this would have quite large effects, not only for equality, but also for efficiency. Of course, the exact ratios we're talking about here, how much do people in recipient countries gain, how much do the immigrants gain, how much do people in the countries of origin gain, may depend upon exactly what kind of state we're talking about. But note that in order for this to improve equality, we needn't assume a particular distribution. It will be okay if the immigrants gain even more than this. And as far as efficiency is concerned, we needn't be so much worried so much about the exact distribution either. According to some efficiency measures, as long as the total kind of is positive, then it's more efficient. According to others, such as the Pareto principle, everyone would have to gain something from this for it to be a Pareto improvement. But that would be the only clause. Well, that's not quite right. Some would have to gain something and no one would have to lose for it to be a Pareto improvement. So it seems that there are really good reasons to have more open borders, both in terms of equality and in terms of efficiency. But aren't there also drawbacks from more open borders? Well, here's one: brain drain. So many Central American and island nations in the Caribbean have more than 50% of their university-educated citizens living abroad in the year 2000. In sub-Saharan Africa, close to 20% of skilled workers have emigrated out of the region. In Zambia, only 50 of the 600 doctors who trained in the country since independence have remained. So these are quite substantial losses to some developing countries. Wouldn't that be a reason not to favor more open borders after all? Well, actually, it's more complicated than this, because there are studies that show that, in general, there's a positive effect of the prospect of skilled migration for human capital formation. And what this means is that if in some country there's a prospect of migrating, then more people will educate themselves than actually end up leaving the country, right? So because of the prospect and the incentive it creates, more people will actually end up having more skills in the country of origin. Now, that's not true in all countries, and in particular, it's not true in some of the poorest countries in the world. So in sub-Saharan Africa, for instance, they are losers in terms of brain drain. But we might try to think about whether there are ways of controlling brain drain through policies. We needn't just look at the present pattern of migration in the world and say we can do nothing about this. We might think about policies we would design to control brain drain. So here are some suggestions what we might do. There could be contracts for people taking higher education in developing nations so that, for example, you commit yourself to, if you have a state-paid education, you commit yourself to working, say, 10 years in the country after that. There could be limits on green cards in developed nations. Or there could be compensation for the intake of highly skilled migrants, such that when a rich liberal democracy takes in a highly skilled migrant, that country would be obliged to compensate the sending country so that they could educate more with the relevant schools. Now, of course, this would be kind of a reversal of the current migration trends, where Western societies compete for the best and the brightest while doing what they can to keep out low-skilled labor. In some ways, we could say that today what is actually going on is that poor countries are subsidizing healthcare systems in rich liberal democracies because we get their doctors and their nurses and so on. So that would be kind of a reversal of that trend. Okay, so now let me pose the question, should global egalitarians endorse open borders? We've seen that there seem to be all these different kinds of advantages in having open borders, or at least more open borders. Well, open borders may, some have argued, negatively affect a country's long-term ability to promote global equality. Joseph Cairns has his examples. He says, let's suppose that Canada opened its borders for all US citizens with HIV who were underinsured or not insured. That would pose quite significant costs for the Canadian healthcare system. Now suppose that Canada opened its borders not just for people with HIV infections, but for people with all sorts of diseases in the US. And now suppose that it opened its borders not just for US citizens, but for everyone in the world. And the scenario that Cairns considers is that that would mean a breakdown of the Canadian welfare state. And the Canadian state would lose its ability in the long run to promote global equality, either through immigration or through development aid. Second, there may be reasons to prefer to improve people's conditions in their country of origin, where these reasons pertain to these peoples already being embedded in particular social and cultural communities. So when many poor people leave for richer countries, they don't particularly do so because they want to live in this country or another European country or the US and so on. They do so to increase their income and their family's income. Now, it might for these people actually be better if they were able to stay where they are with their families and friends and so on, and with the culture they like or enjoy or prefer, and receive help there. And thirdly, there may be more efficient ways of promoting global equality than promoting large-scale migration. In particular, aiding people in their countries of origin will have a number of advantages, we might argue. So the costs of benefiting the worse off will generally be lower in developing nations because a given sum of money will have greater purchasing power there. Second, spending the money in developing nations will tend to stimulate local markets. And finally, it's in general not the poorest people in the world who migrate, and so opening borders will in general not promote their interests. So what this argument suggests is there may be, in fact, be better ways of promoting global equality than just opening up borders. Okay, I'll skip this one. And in some way, this is also the conclusion that Joseph Cairns arrives at. At least he points out that a number of the main worries about open borders seem to propose a world of gross inequality. This is because in such a world, large numbers of poor people have a great incentive to move to rich states. And the worries he's thinking about here is the kind of worries that people often have about immigration, threats to the rule of law, threats to liberal values, threats to social cohesion, crime, terrorism, threats to workers, low-skilled workers who are being... who have more competition for jobs because of immigration, cuts in social benefits, and so on. But if we had a world in which resources are much more evenly shared, these incentives would be much smaller. So what Cairns is proposing is kind of open borders, but for a just world, a world in which there aren't these great inequalities between individuals in different countries. Now, I tend to accept this idea that there are better ways, more efficient ways of promoting global equality than just by opening up borders. However, that doesn't mean that migration doesn't have a role to play. First of all, a large number of people are very difficult to help in their country of origin, and most notably, refugees. Second, if we kind of move a bit more from ideal to non-ideal theory, it's unrealistic to imagine liberal democracies implementing optimal policies to promote global equality, at least in the short run. And so the best strategy may be to argue for piecemeal improvements in different spheres, including global economic institutions, development aid, and immigration policies, which means taking in more people who get access to the benefits of the welfare state. And particularly regarding immigration, contemporary policies of systematically encouraging brain drain and limiting the immigration of low-skilled workers have little to be said for them from the point of view of global lack of. Okay, thanks for your attention.